Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello from Nature Now and your host today, Mary Robson, and I'm here with Nora Petridge, who's our engineer and will help with observations. Welcome to autumn. It's here. The rain has given roots some needed water. Vine maples have turned red. What I notice the most, night comes earlier, morning arrives later. A couple of observations. The first is, why don't cedar trees have lichen and moss all over the bark? Mossy trunks and branches are everywhere in our forest, such as the big leaf maple, which is thoroughly covered with almost no branch or trunk bark visible. Douglas fir shows us moss piled up on the shadiest side, but don't expect that to indicate northerly direction because moss can appear anywhere on a Douglas fir. But western red cedar, the iconic tree of northwest forests, does not seem to attract moss in such heavy quantities. Why? One writer wrote, "The bark is usually clean, being too acidic to encourage lichens, fungi, or moss." That broad statement comes from Daniel Matthews' fine handbook, Cascade Olympic Natural History, 1994. The puzzle for today is not solved because old growth western red cedar definitely has some lichens and moss, but a young tree that I observe closely does not have moss yet. Its great grandfather does. Check this out on your next hike. Now, a bit about the chipmunk. The sound of something rolling down my garage roof reminds me that winter is coming. A chipmunk is collecting Douglas fir cones. They do store food for winter, even though winter is less demanding here than in many chipmunk habitats. The east side of my garage wall has heaps of Douglas fir cones, gathered and piled, and obviously not windblown. Some of them look quite old and many are newer. And come January, those piles will be a fine spot to watch chipmunks.
And here's some news from the Marine Science Center. Abalone are slow-growing, long-lived marine snails. They live in rocky nearshore habitats. They are critical to the health of rocky reef and shore ecosystems. Once their population declined, their recovery has been limited. Pinto abalone is the only abalone species found in Washington State, British Columbia, and Alaska, and therefore is referred to as the northern abalone. Ocean acidification changes in salinity, and higher water temperatures may potentially affect the viability of abalone larvae or adult shell formation in the future. That is from SeaDoc's website. The Port Townsend Marine Science Center has been working for years to raise and distribute small pinto abalone, and on October 7th at 10 a.m., a free Zoom presentation on Marine Science Center's annual stewardship meeting will present conservation work for the pinto abalone. The meeting will be moderated by Nan Evans, KPTZ's Nature Now host. Go to the Marine Science Center website, ptmsc.org, to register for the talk.
And finally, our mystery sound. Our guest today is Bob Jepperson, an observer and recorder of changes in the woods where he lives on Fidalgo Island near Anacortes. Many of you have listened to him on Nature Now with me previously, and what we are going to do today is analyze a little bit the seasons, where are we, and talk about what it means to be someone who goes to the woods for more than 10 years, almost daily. Bob's book, Wild Love Story, uses his photography and his sound recording. So welcome, Bob.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. The other thing I would like to celebrate today is air, because you mentioned coming back from a morning walk with having a pleasure to breathe the cool, humid air. And I would like all of us to remember that taking a deep breath and being comfortable is not a regular thing. So let's start with what you do. And somewhere along the line, you'll probably throw in a little bit about why you do it. You go to the same place every day. And where do you go?
Well, I've always had a wild place to go to wherever I lived. And it's been in my backyard at times. It's been after a long drive at times. I'm very fortunate here on Fidalgo Island. We have almost 3,000 acres of what's called the Anacortes Community Forest Lands with 50 miles of trails for access. And it was actually 2 years before I even discovered the place. And once I discovered it, I began to explore it. And once I explored it, I began to be intrigued by the life around the beaver ponds. And so, yes, there's 3,000 acres, but I probably confine my visits to 400 or 500 acres, I suppose, that include Little Cranberry Lake, the Big Beaver Pond, the Little Beaver Pond. Those are the main bodies of water. And then the last few years, this is my 11th year of going almost every day. And particularly the last few years, I've gotten to know some of our wild neighbors as individuals. So that really adds new intrigue to my visits, especially the owls. I tend to focus a lot on owls, especially the great horned owls have a variety in their voices that allows me to identify about 10 of them as individuals. And then I can keep track of where they are year round. It's easy during the nesting season to follow a pair of owls, but once they disperse with their young, then it's difficult to follow them. But if I hear them in January and I recognize their voice, I know where they are, and it's just fun for me to know. Well, they live through the winter, they're still here.
Bob, it sounds as if you have made a community and you're part of the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm definitely a visitor. I don't confuse the visitor status that I have with the resident status that they have. They have jobs to do. They have to make a living every day or lose weight or worse yet, die. And so I have the benefit of all the comforts of home and then I go over to visit. But I do like to become as familiar as I can.
Well, there must be some aspect of the wildlife becoming accustomed to you because you're there on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. I would say that if I've spent up to 6 hours a day with one owl, and it doesn't take too long before a wild creature views you as no threat. And once they get to that point, then they live normally, and that's what I want to watch. Like, I don't call owls. I don't imitate animals. I'm not there to try to exert any power over them. I just want to be a neutral observer. And so being there really helps in that regard.
I have a question about owls. We have had several shows on owls, and I have thought of the great horned owl as being somewhat nocturnal.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't had the same experience? The only one I have seen here on the edge of my woods was just at dusk as it was getting dark. But I have never seen it in the daytime. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about that.
Well, I would say the extreme season for owls being diurnal is when they have nestlings all the way through the stage where their young are finished serving their internship as hunters. So that could be from, let's see, with a great horned owl, that could be from March through July. And the nights are not as long as they are in the winter, and they've got extra mouths to feed, and so they have to hunt in the daytime as well.
And one of the things that you are known for is the beauty of your photographs, which certainly shows up in your book, Wild Love Story. And I wondered, describe the equipment you carry if you're fully suited up. You're ready to record, you're ready to photograph. Mm-hmm. Are you clunking along?
I have had to find a balance between carrying everything I, quote, need with enjoying my outings. And so I don't take everything. Forest photography is it's a good place to learn photography, because photography is all about light. That's all that cameras record. We think we're taking a picture of an object, but all it's doing is recording light. And light has a nature and it has an amount. And the forest is by nature dim, because we're overhead, there's nothing but solar panels, all the boughs and leaves that are, so the only thing that they don't capture is what I'm left with at ground level. And learning to do photography in low light is a good challenge. That's a subject in itself. So I started out for a few years carrying a 105mm macro lens. The advantage is that you can take pictures of anything from like 2 inches away to infinity. The disadvantage is if you see wildlife, it's only a 105mm lens, and so it doesn't bring things ever very close. Then I went to a 200mm lens, and now I carry a 300mm lens. I guess I have for 4 or 5 years. That's the end of the line for me. 300mm is as long as I'm willing to carry. The lens alone weighs 6 pounds. The camera weighs 2. The monopod weighs 2. So it's like carrying a junior bowling ball around. But the fact that I have it on a monopod allows me to carry it like a suitcase or over my shoulder or to cradle it like a baby. So the monopod really helps as far as carrying it. And then when I find something to photograph, it helps me steady the camera.
Well, the results speak for themselves. And I wondered if you have any advice for someone who wants to start a steady observation of one place. When we did some natural history studies here, people talked about having a sit spot. You'd pick a spot, plunk yourself down in it for 20 minutes or so and write what you see. But in your case, you're peripatetic, you are moving. And I just wondered what you would say to somebody who says, wow, imagine that, years and years and years of walking in the same place. How would someone get started?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it would be the same as asking someone, how do you find a friend? If you find a friend, it's the right person to have an emotional attachment with. And once you develop that emotional connection, then you can't keep them apart. I've found that emotional connection with this particular place. And so I just want to be there every day. I have a life at home, so I can't be there all the time. But there are days when I could spend a long time over there. It's just a wonderful place to be. And it's a different world. It's very refreshing too. When I walk over the threshold into the forest, I experience an immediate sensation. I'm there, and it's wonderful feeling.
Well, it shows up in the way you speak about it. We were going to talk about a few specifics of things that have happened in this forest. And because we're so aware of fire and smoke at this point, and so grateful when we have clear air, you mentioned that at one point there was a forest fire in the forest you visit.
We've had a few small ones, but we had one big one. It was in August of 2016, so just over 4 years ago. And it took place on a steep slope on the east shore of Little Cranberry Lake. And there's a trail that leads up to an old mine opening. It has its appeal to some people who want to do something after dark that they wouldn't want to do in public. And in this case, they caught something on fire, and then that fire grew. And a fire crew from the Department of Natural Resources showed up within a day, and then helicopters were busy with other fires, but they got a helicopter here 2 days later. Fortunately, the lake was right there, so they could lift buckets of water and drop them on the fire. But by the time they got it out, it was 18 acres. And I was there this morning. I'm there fairly often, just seeing what's happening 4 years later. Let me describe what happened initially. The forest that the fire went through hadn't had a fire for a long time. You can tell by the trees. We have old growth trees with they're black 40 feet up. that show fires that could have happened decades, maybe even centuries ago. But this area, the trees are no larger than maybe 3 feet in diameter, and most are quite a bit smaller. And the fire went through and stayed on the ground. Where there was a lot of buildup of fuel on the ground, the flames went up the trees and blackened them for 40 feet. The young cedars, 30 and 40 foot cedars, they died, all of them. The larger Douglas fir, most of them survived. If you hike across the other side of the lake and look back, though, you can see a color difference in that area. So the trees aren't as healthy. And when you're actually in the burn area itself, and look at the bark, the blackened bark has sap weeping through it in places. Wow. So there's little rivulets, little creeks, and sometimes cascades of pitch that's turned, sap that's turned white. So the tree may have lived, but it got hurt and by the heat. And this year, woodpeckers in a few places are starting to strip areas of the bark off. So when they sound on that bark, when they tap on it to see what's behind it, they're hearing something that leads them to believe there's food back there. Insects is what they're after. And I don't know if they're finding anything. We'll know, because if they're rewarded, they'll keep this up. And if they're not, there won't be much more of it. But about 1 foot patches of bark is what they're tearing off right now. And of course, that will further injure the trees. So this whole drama is going to take years to unfold to find out what effect the fire had.
I think that given what has happened in the West Coast this summer, there are going to be thousands and thousands of acres in recovery in some way. So it's interesting to hear what you're observing and seeing. Mm-hmm. Well, we've seldom had so much thought about fire and trees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A couple of other things about the area that you visit. There is the pond, and there is the great yellow pond lily. I think we may have talked a bit about this in the spring, but it hadn't really grown up. You said this transforms the beaver pond. What happens, and can you describe the course of its life?
It's hard to separate the beaver from the great yellow pond lily. The beavers in our area, like most areas in North America, were trapped out. And they've been back in our forest lands for about 40 years. They'll go to an area where a creek runs through the forest and select sites to build dams. And then, depending on the terrain, the pond that forms behind it might be long and narrow, or it might be quite broad. And we have, well, one is the Big Beaver Pond, which covers many acres. The beaver lives there. Yeah, there's a lodge on the shore opposite from the trail that people can walk on. It looks like a miniature Mount Rainier of mud and sticks. Right now, it's difficult to see because of all the green vegetation on it. But in the wintertime, it's very easy to see. And once the pond is established, if it's the correct depth for the pond lilies, they grow rhizomes across the pond bottom. And rhizomes seems like you're talking about a network of strands, but these rhizomes get many inches in diameter. It would be like having a bed of snakes in a pit, and they actually have a reptilian surface. They look very reptilian. When one gets torn loose and washes ashore, the first one I ever found was very mysterious to me. In the next book, I'll have many more pictures of the rhizomes of the great yellow pond lily.
But are these rhizomes edible by any wild creature?
Oh, yes, the beaver eats them. And when they're freshly torn from the bottom, they're woody. And so I can hear the beaver chewing on them from, a distance of 100 feet. But as they rot, they almost become like tubes of jelly. And they eventually decompose and go back into the soup of the pond. So once the roots are established, and they send up two kinds of shoots, and on the stems of most of them are leaves, and they emerge through the water like the tip of a spear. The leaves are rolled up, and then they unfurl once they're in the air and they lie back on the water's surface. And it goes beyond that. With the great yellow pond lily, the stems continue to grow and they elevate the leaves, 1 to 2 feet above the water. And they're just thick out there. And so it's basically a pond lily forest on top of the water. And that forest shades the pond, keeps it cooler, and provides cover for many species. For example, all three of the ducks who raise young in our area out there prefer the ponds with pond lilies on them, because then they can migrate around among the pond lilies and have cover from the predators, like the bald eagles who come every year when the ducklings are out there.
Well, I had wondered, looking at your picture of that, if it was possible for a duck to use the pond with that much life going on in it. But obviously, it not only they can use it and it helps them, which is terrific.
Yes.
I noticed that you mentioned your next book. The prose and pictures in Wild Love Story have really impressed me and a number of other people I've talked with. It's rather poetic. Do you have plans for another book? We need to get that across at this point.
I do. That's the short answer. The long answer is the way I wrote my first book is the same way I'm writing this book. It's been 3 years since I published Wild Love Story, and I write as I go because things happen. And when I happen to witness something that's particularly exciting out there, I like to come home. I call it riding a wave of emotion, or surfing a wave of emotion is better. And I just spill onto my keyboard. I want to be writing when I'm emotionally involved in the subject. And then it won't seem like an academic book, like a science book. And so I collect.
But you don't want a science book, in other words.
No, I think that too much of nature is in the realm of science. And there's a place for art out there, the art of writing, the art of photography, music, whatever you can bring to it. Because it's wonderful, and most people who are out there have emotional reactions to it. Mm-hmm. It's not a cerebral thing. I've collected so far about 80 writings, and some of those will find their way into the next book. And I'm hoping, health permitting and everything else, I will work on it this winter and see how far I can get on actually putting it all together.
Wonderful. Have you thought of a title? Does it, or will that come after it's come together?
The first one began with the word wild, and so will the second. And I'll keep the rest of it a secret for now.
Well, perhaps you'll be able to reveal the secret the next time we can have you on the radio.
I consider that forest that's my university, that's my library, that's my internet, that's everything. And I want everything that I learn to be based on what I see out there and hear out there.
Great. Thank you. That is a perfect wind up to our talk with you today.
Okay.
And enjoy this beautiful autumn, Bob.
Oh, I am. And always good talking with you, Mary.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Our mystery sound. Here is what it is. My kitchen stove vent opens onto a low shed roof, and one evening, while cooking salmon, I heard scratching, and I looked out to see three raccoons trying to take the vent apart. They have most of the capabilities to do that, except opposable thumbs. The local subspecies is Proconloter pacificus, found in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, but the most widely distributed eastern raccoon is also here and probably trying to open your garbage can at this very moment. They eat anything. Since the diet consists of such a variety of different foods, the raccoon was called one of the world's most omnivorous animals. The digital capabilities of raccoons are directed by considerable intelligence. In one study, raccoons were able to open 11 of 13 complex locks in fewer than 10 tries, and they had no problem repeating the action when the locks were rearranged or turned upside down. This is thoroughly scary if you're trying to keep a raccoon out of something. The scientists concluded that raccoons understood the abstract principles of the locking mechanism, and they have remarkable learning speed. Predators of raccoons include bobcats, coyotes, and great horned owls. All of those are present locally, and I think the automobile could also be listed as a predator. Raccoons are poor neighbors. They can establish themselves as complete pests. How they behave makes it difficult to respect their intelligence, because they're using their intelligence to interfere with what humans want. One raccoon study concluded they make impossible pets because it is extremely difficult to teach them to obey commands. That's it for Nature Now in the second week of autumn. Thanks to Nora Petrich for engineering and helping with observations when we can't be together in the studio. Nature Now airs Wednesday at 12:05, Thursday at 5:05, and Saturday at 12:30. To repeat a show, check on KPTZ podcasts. Thank you.
They ask me how I knew my true love was true. Cannot be denied. They said someday you'll find gets in your eyes.